This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. My co-host Craig Blumenschein is on vacation. Coming up in the second half of today's show, we hear from a psychologist to talk about behavioral health. But we are going to start today with COVID. It impacted all of us. And for one young man, a lost job didn't really get in his way.
Funny enough, the whole thing actually comes back to me being bored during COVID.
That is Seth Varner. He is the creative force behind Wondermore Publishing, and he is currently in North Dakota on one of a few trips where he is planning to visit every single incorporated town in North Dakota. He's already done it in Nebraska and South Dakota and a couple other places, and the aim is to put together a travel guide. I caught up with Seth just before he came to the state for this visit. Seth, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me on the radio. Ashley, I appreciate you taking the time to learn more about my project.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to learn more about the state that I have lived in most of my life and worked in for all of my professional life here. And I feel like you definitely know way more about the state than I do. Where did this idea come from to visit every single incorporated community in a state? You've done this already a couple of times now with Nebraska, South Dakota, Kansas, and Iowa.
Yeah, so funny enough, the whole thing actually comes back to me being bored during COVID.
That's
how the whole idea for the project came about. So I currently live in Nebraska, but as you said, I've been to every incorporated town in my home state, Iowa, South Dakota, Kansas, and now I'm working on North Dakota. But the idea for Nebraska just came about because I was a freshman in college at the time. You know, COVID hits in March of 2020, and the world essentially ends. You know, we're all
great time to launch travel plans, Seth.
I know. Well, no one else was on the road. Gas was cheap. I was bored. So after getting bored of working at Dairy Queen all day, every day, and just really not being able to do a whole lot around my little hometown, Oahu, Nebraska, I came up with the idea to go visit every incorporated town in Nebraska with one of my buddies, and we went around the state, and my mom at one point said, make a Facebook page so I can see your pictures. I'm like, okay, Mom, sure, I'll make a Facebook page, and I'll show you where I'm going.
Thanks, Mom.
Right, and like somehow, some way, that page blew up, and we had all these followers coming in from all over the state, and the media started reaching out, and at that point, I realized it was going to be a big project, and Facebook page blew up to like 25,000 followers by the end of the year, and I got the idea to write a coffee table book from those followers. About 40 to 50 people said you should write kind of a travel log slash guide based on all the communities you've been to, and I kind of went from there, and that's kind of how the whole company started. I just did it in other states afterwards.
Safe to say these books are dedicated to your mom, huh?
It's, you know, if it weren't for her idea or even my dad inspiring travel in me as a kid, like this company never would have come about, nor this project, these ideas. Like I should be working for a pro sports team somewhere, but that's on the back burner.
Okay.
Probably not going to happen now.
Well, the business is called Wondermore Publishing. You can find out more at wondermorepublishing.com. Seth, we've both said the word incorporated town a few times here. And of course, with places, yes, there is sort of a census or a legal definition of has to have a post office or whatever it is that makes a place a legal or a census designated place. But from your perspective, what makes some place, a community, if you will?
I choose incorporated towns just because they have the mayor, city council, kind of like a local government, and they don't have to rely necessarily on the county. You know, every municipality in the state, they came together because at some point in time, typically in the early 1910s, you know, even before the turn of the century, a group of immigrants came together and they decided to make a little settlement, you know, take advantage of the Homestead Act and all those things. Then the railroad came through and wanted to place a depot, and a little town site sprung up, and you had your general stores, and your barbers moved in, and your blacksmiths, and all these people came together to form a little settlement so they could start their own little economy in the area and help each other thrive with one another. And so, you know, not every one of those little spots necessarily became an incorporated town, but
sure,
that's kind of the definition I would give as a community. It's all these people who came from across the world to start a new life in North Dakota. And you see that frequently all over the state. You know, I would say 95% of the towns I'm going to were big railroad towns at one point, whether it be for the Great Northern, Northern Pacific, or the Soo Line. And from there, you know, some communities have grown, and some have kind of started to fade away a little bit. But I try to visit every one of them, no matter how small the population or how big the city is.
What kind of commonalities are you seeing on your travels?
So I would say about the whole state is super kind. I mean, down here in Nebraska, we have the whole Nebraska nice saying. I heard the same thing the other states too. You know,
like, there's a lot of states I'm noticing say that.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I've heard the North Dakota nice thing termed already too. And I mean, it's true here in the Midwest. Like, we all look out for each other as neighbors, you know, even if we have no idea who the other person is. Like, you'll always see it on, like, the interstates and things. Like, people are helping each other change a flat tire. Or, like, in my case, you know, I'll be going to a town of 40 people, and the closest hotel is an hour away. And people are like, oh, you know, if you need to couch surf, or if you need somewhere to stay, like, yeah, feel free to stay at our place, or we'll make you a home-cooked meal and those kinds of things. So the hospitality is just amazing.
Well, yeah, I got to ask you about a budget for this here. This is a huge project.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I honestly, there is no budget. I use basically just the funds that I've received from previous travel guide sales. I wrote a book about each state as I went along, and so I use profits from that. I'm partnered with Facebook, and I make a little bit of money from each post, kind of in the same way that, like, a YouTuber would make money off of their videos.
Okay.
Very, very similar concepts that Facebook rolled out a couple of years ago. And then I do name contributions for the back of my book. So if people are, you know, if they're really inspired by my project, or if they want to memorialize, you know, a family member, advertise a business, whatever, I allow people to donate $5 to put a name in the back of the forthcoming North Dakota book for life. And some people take me up on that offer as well. So,
well, let's talk a little bit more about this book. The Wander More in North Dakota book is coming out fall of 2024. We are visiting with the creative force Seth Varner behind this project, looking to visit all 355 of the state's incorporated communities throughout 2024. When we are recording this, you have visited a little more than 70 of those 355 towns. Are you going to hit your fall goal?
Oh, absolutely. So my whole plan is I will do about an eight, well, usually it's like 7 to 9 days or so. I'll come to North Dakota, and I kind of make my little plan. So I have a Rand McNally map of the state, and I'll kind of mark off a region that I think I can reasonably visit within that 7 to 9 day stretch. And I'll do as much as I possibly can in between those 70-ish towns or so, as I'm going around taking pictures and meeting people and doing all that stuff. So I started in April. My May leg of the journey is actually going to be ongoing, probably when this interview is out on the air. And then I'm hoping to do one more trip in June, July, and August, and then by November I should have the book ready to go just in time for Christmas.
And people can follow along on the journey on the Wander More in North Dakota Facebook page. I want to talk to you about what the role of a coffee table book is in a digital age, a lot of us reading on Kindles, and then the role of the travel guide in the age of things like Airbnb experiences and Yelp reviews. You must be pretty confident that these things are still valuable.
You know, there's something to be said about actually holding a book in your hands. Like, I don't know about other people, but I personally, I strongly dislike reading on, like, a Kindle or, like, an e-device. And I know a lot of the older generation would agree with me. It's like, there's just something about being able to go sit on your patio and flip through a book and, you know, read about North Dakota history, or if you're actually like in the towns, like say you're on the road in Western North Dakota, you're in the middle of, I don't know, Theodore Roosevelt National Park, and you want to learn a little bit more about it, and you know, your phone doesn't work. There's no data. You can't get service. And so what better thing to have than a little paperback book that you can open up that does not require the internet, and you can flip through and learn some things. But you know, we're kind of in the age now where a lot of things have gone digital. Even, you know, I'll admit, even as I research a lot of these towns, a lot of my stuff comes digitally, and then I'll talk to a few people in the communities to get some of that oral history as well. But I think there's something to be said just about having that actual hard copy book that kind of resonates with people. And that's why I stick with that. And I don't really ever have plans to do ebooks or anything, 'cause I just think there's something special about having, you know, something you can take with you wherever you want, and it's always going to work.
And you're doing all your own photography?
Yes. So I take all the pictures with my iPhone 12. No fancy Nikons or Canons. Like, I did journalism in high school, and I know how to use all that stuff, but I've found that that iPhone cameras are super high quality, and it's just all about the angles.
I actually ended up losing a camera on my last vacation, and I can't even bring myself to be sad about it, because my husband's got a real nice iPhone and he just takes over all of those.
Well, right. And I even thought to myself before North Dakota, I was like, maybe I should get like the newest iPhone because the pictures are going to be that much better. Like, that's the only reason I upgraded my phone now, is to get a better camera or maybe more storage.
Yeah. it's shocking how many things there are happening in our pockets here. Casual mention here of studying journalism in high school, and now here you are publishing books that you didn't even mean to be publishing out. The last known reference of a job here is a Dairy Queen during a pandemic shortly after college. What prepared you for this?
So I think it was kind of a combination of things. So Wandermore is kind of a combination of all of my interests. So growing up, I was always very into writing. Like, I loved writing little stories for my classmates. I had a book series called Fluffy the Kitten, where I would send my cats on adventures all around the world. And my teachers were nice enough to let me kind of read those out loud to the class. And I remember as a kid, at least I had been told, my first word was book. Not mom, not dad. It was book. Which is crazy to me. And just having that opportunity, you know, like right at a young age, I was enamored, or maybe not enamored is the word, but I was fascinated by words. So I took an interest there. And then I was fortunate enough that my dad was working on this kind of family tree project, in which he was going around taking pictures of all these little cemeteries and churches and those kinds of things that were relevant to our family history for that ancestry project. And I got to tag along on some of those trips as like an 11-year-old. And I was taking pictures of the things that interested me, like the water tower, or like, I remember taking a picture of a Walmart that was green because I was just fascinated. It's like a 10-year-old. I
Where'd
thought they were all
come
blue,
from?
You know, like just weird things like that. Things that catch the eye of like a third grader.
Yeah.
So the writing came about, the travel came about, and then you fast forward like a decade or so. And I helped with the yearbook in high school, so I kind of knew how to lay out books and layouts and all that kind of stuff. And I started taking pictures, and around the same time I started planning my family vacation. So you throw all that in with just, you know, me being a Gen Zer and loving social media, and you know, you combine social media, photography, writing, travel, and then my eventual business degree, all that together comes up with Wandermore Publishing, where I get to travel around taking pictures of little towns and writing about their histories.
There is a pretty significant post along with each of the towns that you are visiting. Is there a through line, would you say, between what you chose to write about Windermere versus Cayuga?
Like, are you saying just like as far as the things I choose to write about?
Yeah. What, you know, of all the history of all of these little towns, is there a through line of what ends up making it into your post?
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I use anywhere between probably 15 and 20 sources per post. I have access to a ton of old, like, centennial books. Shout out to the North Dakota Historical Society, Digital Horizons for that, as well as some other thing like railroad books and those kinds of things. And so, you know, a lot of the time I'll read the full history of a town. It's like, I'll be going through for like, it could be an hour or so of just reading. And then in my mind, I'm like, okay, like what stands out to me? So I try to focus on what happened, like when the town was being formulated. So I'll mention like the railroad and how it got its name and like maybe some of the original settlers and businesses. And then I try to focus on things that really stand out to me. It's like, okay, like, did they have an early university that's, you know, maybe it's been closed for 130 years and sure, people wouldn't know about that? Or like, who are some of the famous people from town? Like, what are the famous sites? It's just like things that kind of make it almost like a little, like, kind of like a trivia book in a way. Just fun little facts like that I kind of try to throw in there. Mm-hmm. And then as well as like the big tourism stops, it's like, you know, everyone loves, like, you know, it's, there's different things for each person. Like recreation areas are a great thing to talk about, or like getting more specific. Like, I know in the book I'll be mentioning, or at least I'll be listing out every golf course, brewery, because it's just big things for people. I'll mention every museum that I come across and some of the things that are there and whatnot. And then even like National Register of Historic Places, which covers everything from, you know, the longest running theater in North Dakota to, you know, the old, you know, the old railroad bridges that are still prominent throughout the state. Just like kind of all kinds of neat sites that people can see.
Yeah. What do you think it says about a place, how we decide what to call things? Like, you talk about Winemere being named after, I believe it was a lake in England, or Walhalla, where I grew up, famed in Norse mythology as a valley of the gods. What does it say about us what we call things?
You know, I love reading about how the towns got their name. So I will say, like, the vast majority, a lot of it dates back to the early railroaders. It's like they'll name it for, like, a daughter of a railroad official, or like Hillsboro is named for James J. Hill, who was, like, responsible for, like, extending the, I don't remember which railroad, I think it's the Great Northern or the Northern Pacific, one of the two, all the way across the state. You know, they called him, like, the Empire Builder back in the day because he was responsible for so many towns. But I think it's cool, too, a lot of early immigrants, it's like they kind of give an ode to their old, where they came from. Like, I think of places like Strasbourg, you know, that's a very German name, and everything around there was settled predominantly by Germans. And, oh, I don't know what, like, other examples.
Still fairly German-speaking, as far as I know.
Yeah, as of the 2000 census, some of those towns, like Lair, they had, like, 50% of the population still spoke German, which I think is fascinating. Like, it survived, you know, that long. Like, 2000 was not that long ago, so.
Yeah.
It's very cool to see how people come up with the names they do.
Do you have a different approach in storytelling at all when it comes to Indigenous communities? And I'm thinking of, in earlier response that you said, you know, it's these communities coming together, these people coming together and creating a life and forging things. And obviously, if you are among an Indigenous population, your interpretation, your lived experience would be very, very different. What is your approach when it comes to the five Native nations represented in North Dakota's geography?
So I'll try to do a little bit of, like, the history of, like, the tribes, or, like, you know, the people who came here long before the Europeans, you know, essentially took over, for lack of a better term, you know. But I think it's cool how you see a lot of that heritage kind of spread throughout the state still. And I personally have not had the chance to visit one of the reservations yet, but on this next trip, I'll be up in the Fort Totten area, as well as, like, Devil's Lake. And it'll be kind of interesting to see, like, you know, There's very large Indigenous populations still living in that community. So being able to hopefully talk to some of those people and, you know, hearing about, like, what life was like for their ancestors long before, like, the European settlers and the Iron Horse was built through and everything. But I haven't had much experience yet, but I am looking forward to checking out some of those areas because they were the original people of North Dakota, and they play a vital role in the state's history.
What's your end game with this project? You said something about working for a professional sports team. I'm assuming you're not meaning as an athlete. Because usually you have to know that by 24.
Oh, yeah. By then, long before then. So I joke about that because of COVID, I was a marketing sales major at the time. And I was working for the University of Nebraska Athletic Department, which may be familiar to some of those living in Grand Forks because of the hockey rivalry that goes on between the schools. That was originally my career path, is I was going to be working for a professional sports team. And then because of COVID, I got sent home, and that boredom drove me to come up with this idea to start visiting every community in Nebraska. And because of the success of that, you know, I had a lot of fun with it and I learned a lot, and it kind of combined all my passions into one. So that's led me now to my fifth state, North Dakota. And I hope over the next few years, I want to be able to say I visited every incorporated town in at least 10 states. And from there, you know, once that 10th book is published, I'll kind of reevaluate. And, you know, I have a girlfriend, soon fiance. She knows, so that's okay.
Okay, I was like, you know, this is going out on the air, right?
She knows.
Okay, congrats.
Right. Doesn't know when or where or any of the details, just that it's happening at some point this year. So, we'll evaluate and we'll see at that point, like, okay, like, can I still continue to do this and, you know, raise a family? Like, is this reasonable for me to keep doing? But I'm only, you know, once I'm done with North Dakota, I'm only halfway to my goal. So I'll be doing this for several years yet. And then after that, you know, I can't imagine I'll be touching any professional sports teams unless someone moves to Omaha.
Yeah. Well, you haven't been to states with professional teams yet.
I guess you were in
Kansas.
As I say, they have the one soccer team in Kansas, and other than that, like, there's no pro sports teams throughout these states. So I might work in, you know, Nebraska State Tourism, or maybe wander more. Like, I'll become more of like a travel agent kind of guy or something like that. I mean, I don't know. I kind of like to say the whole nobody knows more than wander more thing, because, you know, you go online and, like, you might look at TripAdvisor or like some of these other big companies, or you'll read these books from people who live in New York, but they're writing about North Dakota. And it's like, well, I don't think they would know more than someone who's actually been to everywhere in this state. So we'll see down the road what Wandermore holds for me. But I know I got a lot of travels ahead of me still.
What's the number one thing you've eaten so far that you regret?
that I regret?
Yeah. I'm going to throw you under a bus, Seth.
Oh boy. I was expecting my favorite food.
I know.
Oh, thing I regret? I don't know if I've tried anything super crazy. I have a pretty tolerant stomach until it comes to like super spicy stuff.
Oh, well, that's not going to happen.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm trying to think like, you know, I've had some really good things to eat, like Wishick sausage and Grandma's Kuchen come to mind. Oh, like, yes. That's some of my favorites. Or like the French dip. I've tried a lot of that. And there's a, I want to say it's, is it Nopala soup?
Nephla.
Nephla soup. See, I'm from Nebraska. That's not a thing down there.
Yep.
I have yet to try that, but I'm looking forward to it.
Well, that one is a delicious one, and we'll hook you up with our own Ricky on here, who has done a Nephla tasting across the state, and he will give you a great deal of suggestions.
I need to know the best restaurant for not Nopala Nephla soup.
Seth Varner of the Wander More in North Dakota project. You can follow along on the Wander More in North Dakota Facebook page or learn more at wandermorepublishing.com. The travel book is due out just around Thanksgiving. Thank you so much for your time today, Seth.
Yeah, thanks for taking some time to talk to me. And I'm looking forward to seeing what the rest of the Peace Garden State has to offer. It's been one of my favorite states so far. Actually, my most favorite up to this point. So I'm excited to see what the other 200-odd communities have to offer.
Still to come on Main Street, a psychologist talks about behavioral health. That's after this.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life. The question why is very empowering. It's about the divine, it's about the moral, it's about the pleasurable, it's about fear. Why is everything? I'm not very good with authority and I'm not very good with limits. And so I like a question that gives me the ability to do whatever I want whenever I want. I was born and raised in Manhattan on the edge of a neighborhood that most people would know as Spanish Harlem. I ended up in North Dakota because they offered me a job. It's that simple. And we've had a very good life here so far. Dispel these myths. Philosophy is boring. I guess I would ask you to ask yourself, are you boring? Do you think you have nothing of interest to offer anybody? You are philosophy. Philosophy is you. Everything you ask, everything you think, everything you want, everything you strive for, this is what makes up philosophy. Philosophy itself is compelling enough and exciting enough that it is pretty much the oldest discipline. And philosophers had more influence on the world than almost anybody. Plato, Aristotle, we live in their world. And so if you want to make philosophy exciting, you have to be exciting. Philosophy majors can't get jobs or make any money. Philosophy is the highest paid major of all of the humanities, and the rate of return is actually the same over a lifetime as engineering. Listen to Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life every second Sunday at 5 p.m. Central, 4 Mountain on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and mental health has been a growing concern for many years. And today we share an excerpt from the Prairie Pulse, a television show, as a host and Prairie Public CEO John Harris visits with Dr. John Ulvin, a psychologist with Sanford Behavioral Health.
Thanks for joining us today, sir.
Thanks for having me.
As we get started, tell the folks a little bit about yourself and your background.
Sure. As you said, I'm a psychologist at Sanford Health. I've been there for this June will be 20 years. I'm the department chair for our adult psychology group. I see patients every day of the week. But I also do some. I have a leadership role within our department, I'm from around here. I grew up about 25 miles south of here. I grew up on a farm. I went to Concordia College, and then I went away to the University of Kansas, and where I got my doctoral degree, and live in the area, and I've got a wife and two children.
Okay. Well, you're here today to talk about mental health awareness, and May is Mental Health Awareness Month. Can you talk about this month and its significance?
The United States has been recognizing a Mental Health Awareness Month since 1949. I was really surprised that it went back that far, and it is largely it's largely due to a gentleman by the name of Clifford Beers. He received care in an institution for many years. He had multiple family members, siblings who were in institutions. And he was a national and international advocate for improving the care of people in institutions and improving our mental health services. So this month is a month to bring awareness to mental health, but it's also its original intent was to celebrate recovery from mental health issues. And I thought that was really interesting to know that it goes back to 1949.
Tell us about your practice and kind of who and what conditions, I guess, you treat and deal with.
Sure. So at Sanford Health, I work in an integrated system. So I work with professionals from many different departments who send referrals to our behavioral health clinic, and I work primarily with adults. I do a lot of treatment of anxiety disorders, depression, trauma. And then within our organization, I also have been doing, for the past dozen years, I work with clinicians who are showing signs of burnout within our organization. So we provide professional services for those folks to help them do their work better.
Have you seen your workload increase over the last few years? Are you seeing more patients?
Certainly, during the time of COVID and after COVID, we actually had a period of time. It was a short-lived period of time, but we had 2,500 patients on a wait list to get into our clinic at one point after COVID. It's settled down significantly from there, but we still have a wait list. And I think the other thing that we're seeing that when our patients come to us, that they tend to be sicker. And so so if they have had a pre-existing mental health conditions, those conditions are a little bit worse. Around this time of year, things can get a little bit better, but on the whole, what we've noticed is just the severity of illness has gone up in this time. There's also there's a survey that's done every year by the American Psychological Association. It's called Stress in America, and what they've found is that the rate of people diagnosed with a mental illness has gone up about 4% in the last year. And up to about 37% of people surveyed saying that they had a diagnosable condition.
Hmm. Well, here's sort of an ignorant question. You said a wait list. I mean, yeah. Is there an emergency room situation with people that need some services quicker to get in?
Of course. So we have a pretty robust social work program within our clinic. So we are working to help get folks to our partners in the community. We also do a lot of care for mental health in our primary care clinics, and then of course we have urgent care as well as our emergency department services.
You know, can you talk some about the new virtual behavioral health visits that I think have been effective for patients, I understand?
They have. Virtual care, which during COVID, approval to do that type of care was given at that time, and we've run with it. And that's happening across the country. Behavioral health in particular is one of the places in healthcare where virtual care seems to be as effective as in-person care. And what that's done is it's really helped to be a more patient-friendly way for our folks to receive care. And then we can serve a broader area for people who need the care. So I see patients well into Minnesota. I mean, for a while I had a patient from the Twin Cities, someone who I started working with here and then had moved. I also see people all throughout the state of North Dakota too.
Counselors are overworked, and especially in middle school and high schools, dealing, of course, with the volume of teens with mental health issues. Can you comment on that and kind of the cause of that maybe? Or?
Sure. I referenced that Stress in America survey, and what they found was that late teens, young adults are among that's the highest stressed group and in the country in this past year. In fact, one of the questions was for them to rate on average how stressed they are on a daily basis, and 62% of the folks in that group said that they would rate their stress levels a 9 to 10. It seems to be more stress for certainly the young adult age group, and then extending to children. Some other statistics that I've come across from the National Alliance on Mental Illness estimated about 6,000 youths in North Dakota have depression, about 57,000 in Minnesota. We are seeing more folks who need the assistance. The other thing that's come out of that survey I referenced, there's a cultural shift in that young adults and teens are much more willing to say, I have a mental health condition and I need help for it. So there's greater awareness among those groups of folks, and they're more likely to ask for help, which is it's a really good thing. But I think we have this combination of our world's a bit more stressed, and then we also have people who are more willing to get help.
Yeah, well, there you're talking about it. You know, so yeah, why are we seeing more teens using the mental health system, care system, and what's going on in your viewpoint? I mean, just society in general has changed, obviously, over the last 30 years.
Yeah, a lot of folks are looking into this, researching this, offering their suggestions about why this is. But I mentioned earlier that we just seem to be less connected with other human beings, and connected in genuine ways like a nurturing, healthy relationship with another person. People are more likely to report that they're lonely. And they're less likely to say that I have a supportive person in my life, and we know that there are actual health risks that go along with loneliness. Loneliness can shorten our lifespan and significantly shorten our enjoyment of life. And I think that so while we have a lot of our children and teens who are on their phones and might be interacting with all sorts of people. What we don't know for sure is to what extent is that equitable to a relationship with a friend. Like we used to think about it, someone on the playground, someone that I would look forward to seeing in school, which they still have some of that too, but there's a change in the way that we're interacting with people. And I think that it appears to be correlating with that increased loneliness and disconnect. And mm-hmm. and humans just don't do very well when we're disconnected.
So is there a shortage of mental health services in North Dakota and Minnesota, and maybe especially in the rural areas?
Yeah, there certainly is. So when I recently came across, it was a map of North Dakota with all of the counties. Outside of Grand Forks County, Burley County, and Cass County, in North Dakota, every other county is listed as a shortage area for mental health. So we have just the more densely populated areas around cities seem to have enough, but they're also doing the care for a lot of surrounding areas too. So we do need more mental health professionals.
You know, is self-diagnosis among people or patients potentially dangerous? And what would be your advice along these lines?
Sure. It's an interesting thing, but self-diagnosis, there's more and more information out there about what does a mental health condition look like. And TikTok is a very, I think, a good example of this, where you'll have people who will post videos and they'll offer what symptoms are supposed to look like, and here's how you know. I think one of the things that is a challenge for folks is that when it comes to like symptoms of anxiety, symptoms of depression, we all will have symptoms of that. So have you felt down for a good portion of the day? Have you felt anxious and worried? Have you felt overwhelmed by anxiety? We all have symptoms, but I think what is important when it comes to diagnosis is that it's really about how are you functioning in your life. And so I think that when folks post, you know, here are the symptoms of depression, what's often missing is how well are you able to carry out the demands of your life? And that's one of the things that we really look for. It's one of the diagnostic criteria that we pay a lot of attention to in mental health. And we try to normalize with folks some of this day-to-day variability that we have in symptoms, and instead look for times when you have both a lot of symptoms, but you're not able to function in relationships, at work, your self-care in the way that you normally would because of those symptoms.
As an employer, what should employers be aware of and offer in terms of mental health health services for employees?
Sure. Maybe one of the silver linings that came out of COVID is recognizing how stressful our work lives can be, and especially in healthcare. And so what I think this is why perhaps Mental Health Awareness Month is a really good idea for us to take a pause, to put more information out to employees about what do mental health conditions look like within the company that's putting this information out. What are the resources? We have internal EAP resources, employee assistance program services. We also have separate services that we offer for our clinicians who are showing signs of burnout. And we've been working hard to have a lot of initiatives around wellness. One of the things that we've been doing at Sanford is a program called Be Heard, where essentially what we do is we teach our employees how to recognize when people are stressed, when people don't seem to be coping well, and we walk through how do you interact with them, encourage them to get help, and then how do you guide them to services. So having that type of mechanism within for employers, what I think about is if you could take almost any employee, pull them aside and say, if you were struggling with your mental health, where would you get care? How would you get help? And to work for an organization where all of your employees could adequately answer that question.
What about advice you might give parents whose teen or child might be suffering or experiencing those symptoms?
Sure. Of course, we have day-to-day fluctuations in our mood and in symptoms that we have. But when you start to notice a pattern where your son or daughter, they are not the person that they are usually, they've significantly changed from what their baseline is, that I think it's important for parents to be able to have open dialogue with their children, to check in with them, to recognize that this is a more stressful time, and how are we going to, as a family, learn how to cope with stress. When they have concerns, we have a couple of really good options on the whole for folks. There are increasingly well-trained people within the school system to help them, certainly to help them initially, and some to provide care within the school system. We also do within our primary care clinics, our pediatric clinics throughout the community, both at Sanford and outside of Sanford. We have a lot more ability to help people with mental health concerns in those places too. So I recommend people to approach their school for the school counselor to start, but know that they can also go to their pediatrician.
Okay. What are you and Sanford doing maybe to kind of mark this month? Did you say getting more information out?
Yeah. So we have something that we've been doing for a long time is Wellness Wednesdays. So it's a Wednesday out of the month that we have a certain activity that's focused on wellness. For this particular month, our folks at Sanford have put together it's a mental health wellness calendar every day of the month with a challenge for folks to try to do some things differently. Try going out for a walk today and see how that goes. Try calling an old friend today. So trying to encourage people to do things that contribute to their wellness. We are also doing a lot with just putting out information about how they can access the Employee Assistance Program. We're doing a lot within our departments to try to encourage, even in our annual check-ins with our employees. I've been working on them in our department, where we ask our folks consistently now, much more so, how are you doing? How are you coping with stress? How's your wellness? We do things at Sanford. We have a paid volunteering day. So you get a chance to go and volunteer for a place of your choosing. We do things like potluck events. We had an event last week that we did to celebrate multiculturalism. So we're trying to bring people together and create an atmosphere where we can look out for each other better.
Well, we're running out of time, but do you find people still nervous about admitting they have a problem and seeking help? And where can they go to find out more information?
Still, there's some stigma that's out there. I think the really good news is it's getting better. People are much more aware of mental illness and mental health. They're much more willing to talk with each other about it. And like I was saying about children and adolescents, a great place to start for us is with your primary care clinics. We have some really good mechanisms to help people there.
Okay. Well, we thank you so much, and we wish you the best.
That was Prairie Pulse host John Harris in conversation with Dr. John Ulvin, a psychologist with Sanford Behavioral Health. Prairie Pulse airs Thursday nights at 8 o'clock Central, and you can watch all archived episodes on our YouTube channel. Still to come on Main Street, spotters, piggers, you'll need a historian to explain. That's after this.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by North Dakota United, an organization of over 11,000 education and public employees serving the public every step of the way. Information available at ndunited.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Snitches get stitches. We learn just how long we've been doing things like this in this week's Plains Folk essay, Spotters and Piggers. Here's historian Dr. Tom Ezern.
One day in 1905, a stranger named Harvey Severn showed up in the town of Litchville, asking where he might find a drink. The state had been dry by constitutional provision since 1889. Severn got more than he reckoned for. Some toughs from the town waylaid him and beat the tar out of him. They suspected he was a spotter for the Law Enforcement League, gathering information to give to legal authorities, which he was. Severin got some public sympathy because he was an amputee with a cork leg. For his injuries, a broken nose and severe bruising to the hip joint attached to the prosthetic, he sued one of the assailants, A.D. Shaw, and won damages. But the settlement also provided that Severin should never return to Litchfield, the scene of the crime. Serving as a spotter, a traveling informant for the Law Enforcement League, the citizen association trying to get prohibition enforced on the local level, was hazardous duty. Nevertheless, the Washburn Leader observed early in 1906, "In many of the papers over the state, we see accounts of the good work done by spotters." A word of explanation here. A spotter is a sort of detective sent out by the Prohibition League. The spotters happen into a pig-infested town, meaning a town with a blind pig or illegal saloon, as a hobo or any character likely to pass as a good booze customer, buys liquor and gets enough information. A few weeks later, Mr. Pig is brought face to face with Uncle Sam. Later in 1906 came the election of Honest John Burke as governor and the appointment of state's attorneys more in line with the prohibitionist cause. One of them was W.H. Thomas of Benson County, who allied himself with Sheriff John S. Aker against the blind piggers. Spotters commenced working Benson County to supply them the intelligence they needed. When the law cracked down, seizing beer shipments and depots, closing blind pigs, interrogating prominent citizens, and shutting down booze-dispensing druggists in Leeds, Brinsmade, Minnewaukan, and Esmond, that led to the composition by an unhappy rhymester of the ballad, "The Blind Pigger's Farewell," I mentioned in a previous essay. The ballad of six stanzas is what we call a lament, that is, a tale of woe, speaking for the blind piggers put out of business. Its author is clearly riffing off of James Whitcomb Riley's poem, Little Orphan Danny, as each stanza ends something like, "And now he's going to get you if you don't watch out." A scan of its stanzas and meter indicates the ballad was meant to be sung to the tune of the common drinking song, Son of a Gamboleer, which today we know as the tune of Rambling Wreck of Georgia Tech. The song is a wonderful piece of historical documentation detailing the deeds of law enforcement across the county and the rout of the blind piggers, its author declaring in closing, "And now goodbye, old partner boy, for yonder comes my train. I won't come back to Benson till my friends are in again. You'd better follow me at once. Don't try to brave it out, for Thomas sure will get you, for you know what you're about."
Dr. Tom Ezern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University, and of course, something of a balladeer. Thanks, Tom. Dakota Datebook is next.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Dakota Datebook for May the 7th. The bicycle, so common today, is a relatively cheap method of transportation. It is an efficient means of converting human energy into mobility. The first bicycle was made of wood, and the rider propelled it by paddling his feet against the ground. Pedals were added in the 1860s, and it became known as the bicycle. The hard ride of wheels with wooden spokes and iron rims led to the nickname of the bone shaker. Wire spokes and rubber tires softened the ride and increased the machine's popularity. The bicycle craze caught on in the United States, primarily in cities, which were more likely to have paved streets. Some bicycles were designed with a small rear wheel and a front wheel as large as 60 inches. These were nicknamed the penny farthing, comparing the large front wheel to the large British penny and the small rear wheel to the tiny British farthing. These were notoriously difficult to ride and were eventually replaced by the so-called safety bicycle, which had two wheels of the same diameter. On this date, in 1904, the city of Fargo began a crackdown on bicycle riders who were zipping around on the sidewalks, forcing pedestrians to dodge out of the way. The riders used the sidewalks rather than taking their chances on the rough and often muddy roads. The chief of police announced that bicycles were banned from 7th Street South between 1st and 8th Avenues. The chief had received numerous complaints about the reckless wheelmen. On one occasion, a child was playing on the sidewalk in front of his house when he was struck by the wheel of a bike and knocked unconscious. Chief Gowland assured the public that his patrolmen would rigidly enforce the new ordinance. The wheelmen objected, but the citizens of Fargo were largely in favor of it. Many of them suggested that the policy should be extended to other streets as well. The bicycle has been refined over the years. Improvements were made in materials, gears were added, and most importantly, the inclusion of brakes. The oil embargo of 1974 spurred the sale of bikes. The development of new models, including mountain, touring, and racing bikes, added to the popularity. Today, the bicycle continues as a popular form of transportation, recreation, and exercise. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Ann Alquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
That's it for this Tuesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, Indigenous representation in the media. We learn about Buffalo's Fire and the Documenters Project and what it means to be in the room when decisions are being made when you are, historically speaking, left out of the decision-making process. That's tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.